The Aussie Fire podcast is a collaboration between Strong Money Australia and Perla, Australia's favourite boring long-term investing platform. Join our hosts, Dave from Strong Money Australia and Hayden from Perla, as they discuss all things financial independence. At Aussie Fire, we're big fans of sharing experiences and talking about money. However, please note that any advice is general and does not consider your financial situation, needs, or objectives. Consider whether it's appropriate for you and, if in doubt, speak to a licensed financial advisor.
Hey guys, welcome back to a new episode of Aussie Fire. Today we're going to do something a little bit different to the topics that we normally discuss. So as promised in a recent episode, today we're actually going to peel back the curtain a little bit and tell you exactly what we invest our money in and why we've chosen to invest in those particular assets and in that particular way. And we'll also share some thoughts that we have around possibly changing our portfolios or our wealth allocation in the future.
Yeah, we're hoping that you find this conversation interesting. Obviously, there are many different ways to invest. So, you know, we'll start up front saying that what we talk about isn't always going to be for everyone. What people invest in depends on their own personal circumstances. And also it changes over time. And that's happened for both Dave and I, and we'll be chatting about that too. But sharing finances is sometimes a scary topic for people. Dave and I generally believe that, you know, more openness when it comes to talking about money is a great cultural change. So, you know, in the spirit of trying to, you know, be participants in that change, it's something that we're looking forward to, you know, sharing with you all today in the hopes that you can learn a bit more. Because a lot of what Dave and I have learned is people sharing their own experiences, you know, before us. So, you know, we'll ask each other some questions and see what we can find out together. So I guess the best place to start, Dave, is just the big high question, which is you've got a portfolio, something that, you know, you use to either, you know, grow wealth or generate passive income, and whether it's like cash, housing, super, shares, business, what does that look like for you generally?
Do you mean what is my current sort of a breakdown or the strategy or what?
Yeah, like what's the breakdown? Not so much like, you know, I have $10 of Bitcoin or something, but, you know, how do you kind of distribute that, even just in percentage terms, or what are things that you might stay away from out of those buckets?
Well, first of all, I actually have $0 of Bitcoin, mate, so I'm $10 poorer than you thought I was. But at the moment, so as to the breakdown, I guess, of where my wealth is currently located, I actually did the numbers on this recently for this episode just so that I could make sure that it's roughly accurate, the numbers that I'm sharing. So at the moment, I currently have around half of my wealth in shares. There's about 20 to 25% of my wealth in investment property. There's about 12 or so percent in superannuation, about another 12 or so percent in home equity, and then very tiny amounts, basically like very tiny percentages in cash in an offset account. And then also I have a very tiny stake in the company Perla, as you probably know, mate, because I've been involved since the very beginning, and I was later offered the chance to invest in a small portion of it, which I took up that opportunity. So, yeah, that's my side of things, mate. What would you say your breakdown is at the moment?
Yeah, like, so right now at the time of the recording, I'm fairly cash heavy at the moment, just because I've kind of been anticipating that at some point I'll need to, well, I guess there's a couple of things. I won't unpack it too much, but high level, it's about 50% cash. It's about...
Wow, that's heaps.
It is a lot. It's probably like 35% ETFs, and then it's about 15% of it's in super. And the super, I tried to play with the super setting. So I think that, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's one of those like higher risk, higher growth parts. So there's probably some ETFs in there, but it's generally a broad-based thing there. And the cash part right now is indicative of the fact that around the time interest rates started going up, I'd noticed savings accounts rates were going way up, and I knew that buying a house was probably imminent. So I said, well, let's just ride the pretty safe interest rate, 5%. That's a relatively decent return. And just kind of sit with that for a while. I will quickly say, though, that there are some regrets I have with that, which we can unpack maybe.
Oh, but, interesting.
But, yeah, right now it's quite cash heavy and in some kind of anticipation for, you know, property to become part of the picture.
So do you want to unpack that a little bit, mate? Is that a property purchase that is coming soon or what's happening there?
Yeah, the hope is that it's coming, you know, basically imminently. And the reason for it is that I kind of, I guess, like many Australians, assume that I need to buy a house at some point to live in. I'm not saying, you know, that's necessarily right for everyone, but, you know, I'd like to own a home of some sort at some point in my life. And sooner is generally better in a decade-on-decade sense. And it kind of felt, I didn't really have a personal psychological desire to buy now, but with interest rates being so high and me not having a cash problem right now because I've been saving so much, it felt like a smart time to buy because the market wasn't super hot. And I had a lot of friends who bought in that like pre-COVID or early COVID era where everyone was just outbidding each other and house prices were crazy. And I thought, I don't have the emotional energy to do that. So I thought I'd buy now. And the other thing that kind of tipped me over was when someone pointed out the stamp duty exemption in my home state of New South Wales. And I thought, I don't really need an expensive place to live by Sydney standards. So if I don't have to pay stamp duty, then if I screw up my choice of a home and I sell it in a year or 2 years, assuming it doesn't crash, the worst I've done is paid some real estate and solicitors to do the transaction. And that's a pretty small price to pay for something that might be, you know, good for me. Yeah.
But you can't, obviously you don't imagine selling it in the future. Is the plan to stay there for a very long time, or do you plan to then kind of sell and move maybe after 5 years or 10 years or something like that? Do you have any kind of forecasts or plans around that?
I'd be pretty happy there. It's looking like it's going to be a 2-bedroom apartment.
What are they, about 1.5 mil?
I think they're probably around 1 mil. I'm generally looking in like some less affluent parts of Sydney around the kind of southwest area between kind of Marrickville and Bankstown would be how I'd describe it. And for those in Sydney, and you know, I'd say that like a 2-bedroom apartment in that part of Sydney is going everywhere from about 450 to 850,000, depending on the quality of it. So like at the 450 range, it's like not undercover outdoor car space. There's like no balconies. There might be a shared laundry. And on the 850 end, you're talking about a townhouse with like, you know, underground parking and stuff like that. So kind of somewhere in the middle of that, probably in that like closer to 700K would be kind of where I'm aiming for.
Okay, cool. So would it be fair to say then that that's not part of your wealth strategy then, and your primary wealth strategy is investing elsewhere, such as like shares and ETFs? Is that correct, or is it part of the idea was to use leverage to kind of gain some benefits of that? Was that part of it as well?
Yeah, honestly, Dave, this is the cool thing about these kinds of episodes and wealth and stuff is it just changed a lot. Like at first, it was actually really simple. I was like, a lot of my money's in cash, 5%. If I have a mortgage, then it's kind of 6% if the interest rate's 6%, because, you know, if I offset a lot of that mortgage, then the cash is earning more. And so I was kind of seeing house as an investment. And then I kind of started to think about how housing returns for apartments aren't too high. And, you know, I've just gone on a bloody journey with it. And now I'm kind of back full circle and thinking about, I think about how people have been talking to me about using money in an offset account that you have spare, not to offset the loan, but, you know, buy shares anyway. Because, you know, if you can get more than 6% on shares, then maybe do that. So as of recording right now, which maybe this will be different in a week, it seems to nearly be like I do want to try and grow out a share portfolio as much as I can while still having a house, for sure.
And so on those shares and on that share portfolio, what you did say, you had about 35% or so of your wealth currently in shares or ETFs. What exactly are those ETFs, or what exactly does that share portfolio look like, mate?
It's a good question. It's funny, you know, at Perlo, when people kind of say, you know, what should I invest in first? You know, like a common answer we kind of give is, in terms of ETFs, is, you know, just pick something and get started, you know, like, because getting started is the hard part of the journey. And I feel like to some extent, I took our own advice a bit too strongly, because I feel like early on, I just kind of picked some things and then just kept putting money into them. And, you know, we kind of uncovered this during a previous conversation where it turned out I didn't even understand some of the things I was investing in until I talked to you about it, and then you pointed some things out. So right now it's mostly some like Vanguard beta shares, broad-based ETFs like VAS and VGS and IVV. And my intention, for instance, was actually to say, I'll probably grab, you know, a quarter of Australia, a quarter of global, a quarter of the US, you know, and a quarter of some hodgepodge other stuff. But yeah, there's definitely a bunch of overlap in my portfolio. But fundamentally, it's like the VAS, the VGSs, the IVVs, things like that. I can be very specific if you'd like, but it's a bit embarrassing, some of it.
No, I think that's good enough. I think that gives a pretty good picture. If you want to mention some of the other ones, you can. But no, you're not required to if that's not really the focus anyway.
Yeah, I would say, like, really quickly, And I think on the topic of, you know, because the questions of what are we investing in are meant to prompt people to think about, you know, how does that compare to them? And, you know, why is what we're doing right or wrong or whatever else? And even my own approach has changed. Like, I think when I started off, I got so excited about dividends and was like, lots of VAS and like high dividend yield things, you know, like super passive income. And then after a couple of years, where I'm at now is more realizing I'm a young person who's probably going to be on a relatively like high enough income that I'm going to be paying a lot of tax on those dividends. So like a lot of my focus now has kind of become on, I should probably own a lot more growth ETFs like VGS now and just let them grow. So I'd say my portfolio is going to end up trending more and more growth wise as I just kind of mull over tax a bit more, which is a whole deep bucket of pain, but yeah.
And you obviously don't plan to be living off this portfolio anytime soon, mate, because you're still well and truly going hard in full-time work at the moment and building, and you're still in the building phase quite solidly, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. And then I also figured out I can always just sell some stuff later anyway. So, you know, rather than have to rely on dividends, like, and I don't know if you or someone else pointed this out, but let's say I have like a really high growth ETF like VGS. Well, okay, and if in 30 years I stop working, I can just sell it down and then use the money I sell that to go buy a high dividend one. And because I'm hopefully not working by then, I won't pay much tax on the sale if I do it gradually. And I think you talked about doing that with your investment properties in a previous episode. And it's so deep and complex sometimes, Dave, honestly. Like, I just like waste 2 hours on it and then it's hard.
That's the tricky part. It really can be, because there's so many factors that can come into play when you talk about portfolio construction and how you choose to set things up and why and how long it's going to stay like that and if you're going to change it later and then what are the tax consequences of that and which portfolio or which strategy you feel most comfortable with, because everyone's in a different boat in that situation as well. So there's so many factors that go into it. So yeah, it's good to highlight things like that. And like you kind of alluded to there, it's not to say that your approach or my approach is the right approach. We just thought we'd share stuff like this in the spirit of transparency and being open with people anyway, not necessarily that you should do X, Y, Z.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm learning all the time. I feel like my understanding is evolving quite rapidly. Do you feel like you've settled on an approach to when it comes to the shares part of your portfolio, or do you even find yourself it changes up quite a lot?
That's a good question. No, it doesn't really change at the moment. I do feel like I have reached a point where I'm pretty well set in what I'm investing in, and I'm pretty happy with the approach that I'm following. So for anyone that's not aware, I'm sure most people listening to this are familiar with my story and my investing journey to date. So at the moment, I'm transitioning still from property to shares, doing that by basically selling a property every few years or so and then investing the money into shares. The share portfolio itself, currently and for a while now, it's basically mostly made up of two index funds, and you pointed these out earlier, Hayden, and that's the Vanguard Aussie Index and the Vanguard International Index. And so most of my share portfolio is those two holdings, and the only other things that are in there right now is two real estate trusts, which I like for the quite high income that they produce. So this commercial property is a lot different to residential property in terms of the cash flows.
Yeah, because when you say real estate, you're talking about like office buildings. You're not talking about like a home down the street kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So these are commercial real estate trusts. So they'll invest in offices and warehouses and logistics centers and shopping centers.
Did you have them during COVID or did you get them recently?
I actually bought them during the after the COVID crash.
Oh, sure. Okay. Because I was going to ask, because I would consider, you know, commercial property sounds like a safe thing, like people go to offices, but I don't know how it responded during COVID, but it sounds like you might have jumped in at a time that people were cautious and benefited from it a bit, I guess.
Yeah. Well, like it crashed and then I bought some and then it crashed some more.
A vulture, and then I bought some more. You're a vulture.
So, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty, mostly around office buildings and the whole return to work type, work from home sure. situation. Yeah. So, there's still uncertainty in that space. And kind of once that uncertainty resolved itself to some degree, then high interest rates started to kick in. So, commercial real estate is very sensitive to interest rates because it's a kind of a yield-focused investment. And sure. these real estate trusts all carry some or varying levels of debt. So, interest rates can be quite impactful on their earnings. So then that was the next kind of challenge, but they seem to be on the road to recovery. I think they'll probably, as a guess, they'll probably kind of pick up over the next few years if interest rates sort of start heading back down or normalize and Armageddon doesn't eventuate, then things will probably return to normal because a lot of them are trading at fairly large discounts to like the values of their portfolios, but that's probably a conversation for another day or a conversation that we don't really need to have here because it's not super relevant. But yeah, those are the only other two things in my portfolios. And to be honest, I will probably actually sell them at some point in the future.
Yeah.
Just for the simple reason that I find that the smaller and the simpler I make my portfolio, the more I like it.
Well, I was actually going to ask about that.
Yeah.
Because I started off with like 10 ETFs and they were just random like cyber security ETF and a health ETF. And then a year or so ago, I kind of sold them out and brought them down to kind of like the indexes, right? And even now I'm kind of looking at it and thinking, I've got like five. That's too many. And when I hear you talking about you've got VAS and BGS and also a retail thing for income, doesn't VAS get you income? Like, why don't you just have the retail thing? Or like, do you know what I mean? And it's like, and then I also look at things like over the weekend, I was telling you, I looked at, you know, this VDHG and the DHHFs and stuff, which when I looked inside, looked like there were a whole bunch of just like mostly international, some Aussie stuff. And do you ever get kind of tempted to just cut one of those three out or cut both of them out for a substitute?
The only thing I could really do at this point is sell what I have and put it into one fund. I can't get, aside from offloading like the real estate trusts, which I might do in the future.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can really do, go from two indexes to one index. So, I mean, that's a possibility, but I don't really feel the need for that. There's two holdings and that's kind of good enough. And so the benefit that I like, which is it may not have much of an effect over the long term versus having just one fund, but the one thing that I do like about separating, say, Aussie shares and global shares and having those two holdings instead of one is that depending on market performance, you can buy the fund that has had the worst recent performance. So you're kind of buying the one that's cheaper at the time. So I kind of like doing that.
If you have like an aggressive growth period in the US where it seems unsustainable, then you think maybe for this next year, I'm just going to keep building out the Australian part of my portfolio. And then maybe the Australian part goes gangbusters one day and it just doesn't make sense. And you're like, this has to come to an end at some point and the US is flat. So you're talking about it gives you, you can basically take advantage of which you feel like is weaker and more prime for your vulturism.
Yeah, without even, well, it happens in two ways. So without even trying to make it like a timing the market type situation. So if you just think about, I've got two funds and I'm going to invest in them equally, as they fluctuate over time, one fund will grow to be a bigger percentage than the other one.
Yeah.
So the other one then becomes what you would call underweight or like under your target if you wanted to have them kind of like a certain percentage between them. So you would naturally want to invest in the one that has underperformed or the one that hasn't grown as much to bring it back up to your target. So not only does it kind of fulfill that need, but it also takes advantage of the fact that that market or that fund or whatever will be experiencing lower performance, and performance between markets waxes and wanes, like you kind of alluded to before. So you benefit from buying when one market is having a lower period and then when that kind of flips at some point over a few month period or few years period, then you'll end up naturally buying more of the other funds. So you kind of benefit in two different ways, I guess, or it serves two purposes.
It's really interesting you talk about that, Dave, because I feel like even I'm learning hearing you talk about it, that there feels like there's a spectrum for me in my head that's like, you know, the more you break up, like you can look at those really catch-all ETFs like VDHG or DHHF or something, and the more you break it up, you know, the more, you know, you can maybe do something wrong and it's a bit harder, but you do have some more control. And like another one I just remembered my friend talking to me about once was when you get those things like, you know, VDHG or something, they have, you know, based on, you know, the fund's description, they have to have like fixed percentages of certain allocations. You know, they've got this much Australia and this much US. So I have seen times, for instance, where if the US goes gangbusters, the fund is like forced to basically sell US stocks and trigger like capital gains events and things that, you know, then flow on to investors, as far as I understand. And I'm not an expert on that, but, you know, I mean, for some people that's great because this smaller ETF this singular ETF that does many things is just managing all of this for you. But for people like you that are a bit more engaged or have an understanding of it, then you can take advantage of maybe something it's doing that you don't want to do.
Yeah, it's definitely not a case where that's always a beneficial approach, because if you're doing it yourself and you kind of separate all those holdings rather than just have them all in one, then you're more prone to second guess what one market is doing versus another market and then change your allocation at the wrong time when it's about to perform better than you thought it was going to. And so you often trip yourself up by trying to do too many things yourself and trying to be too clever as well. So the control side of things can be beneficial, but it can also be a big drawback for some people as well. And so psychologically and practically, a lot of people are better off with less holdings and less things to do and less things to look at and less things to kind of dissuade them from just sticking with their current approach. So it can be tricky, man. It's definitely not the case where there's pros and cons to both options.
Yeah, I think one thing I wish I could encourage people to do in terms of how I've come to understand my own mistakes is a lot of people do what I do. They start big and they collapse it down. And it kind of makes a lot more sense to do it the other way, right? You go buy the most broad-based generalist thing, broadly speaking, and then, you know, you say, well, actually, I might want to control these elements of my portfolio, so I might sell that or I might go and buy it in a different way here.
Yeah. At one point, man, in the beginning, I probably would be about 9 years ago at this point when I first started investing in shares, I just started buying individual companies because I didn't really know much else, right? So I was buying individual companies and I ended up with like, I don't even know how many shares it was. It would have been more than 30 in my portfolio. And then I found like diversified funds, you know, like listed investment companies that the older LICs that most people are aware of. And then I was like, oh, actually, these are pretty good. Then I don't have to worry about picking stocks because it wasn't really working out very well. You know, it was like some would do well and some would do terrible. I'm like, I'm not really sure this is working out. So then I found like a more boring approach. I'm like, oh, this is pretty good. Maybe I'll do that and let someone else take care of it for a small fee. And then I did that and then later moved to indexing. And I suppose we should touch on this while it's come up, but let's talk about why exactly we've chosen the particular funds or the particular strategy that we have.
Yeah, I think for me, it's funny. I'll tell you a quick story is that there's only two occasions that I seriously considered buying shares, and it was Qantas and Boeing. And I like planes and I read plane news and, you know, it's a bit of a, you know, engineer cliche. But the thing was, I was really about to buy Boeing stock because I was like, Boeing is like a massive company, like Coca-Cola. Like they like defense contracts. They are so deeply rooted in the, you know, Western world. Like they're not going anywhere. They make bloody planes and things. And I thought about this and I nearly bought it. And I was like, no, don't do that. Buy ETFs, buy indexes, you know, follow your own advice. And then like a week later, those horrific crashes happened with the 737 Maxes, you know, like the first one. And the stock tanked and the company's been, I'm not saying it's performed poorly, but I never would have predicted that just randomly they had a plane malfunction so poorly for a company that old. And then similarly, I nearly bought Qantas stock because I thought about Qantas and I saw like they're such a good business for an airline. Like I remember someone said to me once, if you got all the airlines together and you like put it in an index fund for airlines, it would like underperform the market by like some crazy number. Like it's like worse than cash or something. So, and I saw Qantas, what a strong business, Australian business, you know, good management of money. And then 4 weeks later, COVID happened and they had to ground the fleet and put the planes in storage. And like those two things for me were really the markers that just like bury that. I never, you know, strictly bought Qantas, but I nearly did. And then I was like, no, I'm going to stay away from that because even these things I feel like I know and understand and I care about, I could have gotten completely destroyed by it. So that's kind of, you know, at least my anecdotal reasoning for why I stick towards all these index funds that are just tracking, you know, broad economies and things that have fairly low risk in the grand scheme of things. What about you, Dave?
That's interesting, man. So you couldn't be tempted. To buy Boeing when the stock price was Boeing.
Yeah, exactly. I thought I knew it. That's the thing. I didn't think I was like an expert or something, but I was like, this is the area that I know the most in when it comes to companies on the stock market. I read the news like every day, like for years. So surely this is where I should go. And it's like, no, because it doesn't matter how smart you are. You're at the mercy of just crap happening in the world all the time with that kind of thing, totally out of control.
And there's how many other analysts that are following the same,
yeah, exactly,
the very same news that you are, and probably have, well, they do have better connections at companies that know what's going on more than you do. And
exactly,
it's so competitive, man. I think the idea is almost laughable that we think we can kind of outthink or out analyze a lot of the people who do it for a living. It's a little bit arrogant almost, isn't it? I mean, it can happen.
Yeah, particularly when they struggle to do it, you know, so for sure. But that's at least why I mostly go through indexes and those broad ETFs.
Yeah, fair point. I think for me, the main reason I became most attracted to index funds, and you sort of hinted at this just before when you mentioned the basket of stocks of airlines that if you put them together would have underperformed the market. It actually turns out that if you put most stocks in a basket, most stocks will actually tend to underperform the market over time. So that might sound a bit strange, but how it works is it's almost like the 80-20 rule in play, like the Pareto principle as it's known. So essentially, a lot of the market's gains over time are driven by a relatively small percentage of stocks in the stock market. So I can't remember the exact figures, but it was sort of like an 80-20 rule where 20% of the companies end up being responsible for 80% or more of the long-term performance of the stock market. Because what tends to happen is a whole lot of stocks end up having terrible performance over the long run. And then a whole lot of stocks end up having like either like very subpar returns or like zero type returns or simply low returns. And then you have a small group of massive long-term winners. So these would be like the Amazons of the world or the Teslas of the world and things like that, or the Commonwealth Banks of the world. So that was the one thing that really swayed me, because what tends to happen is if you miss a couple of those long-term winners, it's essentially inevitable that you're going to underperform the market, because the returns from those companies end up being so outsized that it's just so hard to keep up if you don't own them. And so that's the main reason why most professionals tend to underperform the market, because by definition, they're not owning everything, so they have to pick and choose, which is fine as a strategy, but it inevitably means you are going to end up missing some of the winners. So it's very, very difficult to know in advance which ones are going to be the long-term massive winners. And so that tends to be why index funds are a pretty decent long-term choice. And that's the main reason that convinced me finally to move towards index funds from what I was doing before.
So, you know, speaking of investing, Dave, there's a particular word you might know called cryptocurrency, which has a hot topic around whether that's called investing or speculating or gambling or anything in between. And I guess we'd kind of talked about this together in terms of where it sits in our own portfolio. Have you ever owned crypto?
No. Have you?
I have.
You have? Does that mean you still do or you don't?
No, I owned crypto before I ever owned an ETF.
Are you the guy? You're not the guy who bought a pizza with 10 Bitcoin, are you, like 7 years ago? And you'd a billionaire, but no, that's not you.
The quick story is like when I was 24, I was quite like, I didn't have much money at all. And I had maybe like, you know, $10,000 in the bank, maybe kind of thing. And I was renting, you know, still kind of young post-university, trying to make my way in like entrepreneurship. And I was living with like a housemate, and he was just like, you should buy this crypto thing. I'd heard about it, buy some Bitcoin. And I was like, no, go away. And then he was like, no, really, you should do it. And then I remembered, because I just bought a motorcycle, and I remembered that the thing that actually swayed me with a motorcycle was like, if I don't like it, I can sell it. You know, you're not buying like pasta and eating it. I was like, well, yeah, I'll get the Bitcoin. And if I don't want it after a week, I'll just get rid of it and maybe lose some money. So he bought me, I think it was like 2 Bitcoin for like, I think it was $1,000 at the time. So I gave him $1,000 and he gave me 2 Bitcoin. For context now, 1 Bitcoin is worth
80,000.
Oh, it's worth so much. Oh my God. Oh, it's worth $100,000 right now. Oh, anyway.
Is that Aussie or is that US?
No, that's Australian. That's a big AUD on my screen. Anyway, point is that it was $500 a Bitcoin, I'm pretty sure, when I bought it. And now it's like $100,000. And I held on to that for like 9 months. And this is way before I owned investments and stuff, right? And what happened was is that I had that little apps where you track it. And I tell you, Dave, owning crypto is a horrifying experience because it's like the market is open 24 hours and it moves in aggressive ways you wouldn't even imagine. You like wake up in the morning and your money's gone from 1,000 to like 2,200 and then it's back down to, it's so all over the place. So you get like stressed all the time. I'm like glued to it. And then at some point, all your friends are talking about trading it. So you think, oh my God, it's doubled today. I'll sell a little bit. And then you sell some and then it halves again. Maybe not halves, you know, it goes down by 20%. So you buy some more and then you realize that you're like, I'm a day trader now and I'm making money off.
This is
you know,
my job.
And it's so easy on the apps. And this was before I think the ATO had really kind of figured out what to do with it. So no one was really that stressed about the tax or anything. And it ended up, I think, peaking at like $34,000. That $1,000 I bought turned into $34,000 by the end of the year. And even by that point, I thought it was still going to keep going up. And then it started crashing and going down. And then a bunch of people I knew who had it got stressed and, you know, depressed and stuff. And I think it got down to like 15 grand. And after so long, I just said, this is not worth the emotional energy. And I don't really believe at this point in, you know, what it is as an idea for myself. You know, maybe I'm uneducated on the topic, but I just said, why do I own this thing that I think is purely a speculative asset? So at one point it was more than half my wealth just by virtue of not having much other wealth. But
wow.
Then I just got rid of it and I said, I'm not touching it again. It's not for me. So I've stayed away from it since like early 2018.
Do you say that because of the volatility or are there other reasons you say that?
Look, it's hard. It's hard being on a podcast recorded and broadcast having an opinion about the topic, right? Because there's a bunch of people right now who are like, oh, thank God he also thinks it's stupid. And then there's a bunch of people being like, what an uneducated swine who's not with the future, you know? But
welcome to the world. You're going to upset people no matter what.
Yeah, that's it. From my current base of understanding, it just seems like a store of wealth that is as arbitrary as gold, has some cool benefits like a limited supply, but it just uses a lot of electricity. And it's like, I don't need a store of wealth in a digital currency. I don't think the governments are going to collapse. Like I had all these people be like, oh yeah, well, what if like the central banks collapse? At least I have some cryptocurrency yet because I can put it on a cold wallet and put it in a safe. And I was like, are you really going to put your like nest egg, the thing that your children will rely on to like manage their life, on a USB drive in a cupboard, hoping that you don't like forget your pass keys or whatever the hell they're called? And I just kind of like got cynical over time about it and said, maybe I'm wrong, but you know, I'm going to go be a normal person and go buy some ETFs. So I went and bought an ETF. I think my first ETF was VGS in 2018. And that kind of started the equity portfolio.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you say store of wealth, I agree with that. And I agree with the idea that, so here's the thing. I'm not one of these people who thinks, it's all a scam. It's all a Ponzi. It's going to zero. I think we're way, way past that idea. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that's a stupid outlook to have. So then you get to the situation where, okay, what do you think is going to happen in the future? Or where do you think it's going? I actually think it'll continue to gain popularity over time. So I think the idea that it goes up more than it goes down is stronger rather than weaker.
Yep.
That being said, I'm still uninterested in it as an investment. It's just one of those things that I just don't really care. I don't know. I just don't really care. So if it goes to $1 million or $10 million and I could have made X amount of money, I just don't care. I don't know what else to say. I'm just not really interested in it as an investment because I don't really.
No, you've actually summarized my thoughts very well, Dave. Because like I don't think there's no money to be made on it. I think people can make money on it. I think that you're right. I think it's going to go up. Like if I kept that Bitcoin now, I'd have $200,000 of Bitcoin right now. But it just wasn't my jam. That's what it came back to. I just thought about it and I was like, I wouldn't buy gold. I don't want to buy a brick of metal and be like, that's not like who I am. I want to put my money in something that I can understand in businesses and, you know, the economy. So you kind of say I don't care. For me, it kind of more turned into like, that's not, doesn't align with my identity at this point. You know, like that's not how I want to see myself making money. Even if I could make money there, like it's just not what I want to do with my money.
Yeah, I suppose another aspect of it too is the, I guess the level of certainty involved. I like to have like a high level of certainty with where I'm putting my money. So maybe it's just that I'm more of a, it's not even more cautious because I don't enjoy investments where there's.
You're a simple person.
Less Dave. Certainty.
Simple is
that,
person.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm simple, I guess. So the idea that, I guess shares and property are what underpin society in terms of if you break them down, they're really just two things. They're businesses and they're buildings. Both of those two things are completely crucial to the functioning of society. And so even if you're not an investor who is focused on price growth, you actually don't need to care. You don't actually need to give a shit, broadly speaking, about whether shares or property are going to be popular investment vehicles for the foreseeable future. You don't even have to care because even if the price of property and the price of shares goes absolutely nowhere for the next 70 years, businesses will keep finding new ways to make more money. And so they'll pay higher and higher dividends to shareholders and properties will keep renting for higher and higher amounts because our wages will be going up over time. Obviously, you can debate how much it's going to go up and whatever, but you don't have to actually care whether the price goes up or not. So you're not reliant on the popularity of it as an investment. So I guess that's what I don't like. To rely on crypto or Bitcoin as an investment, you more or less have to rely on the popularity of it as an investment or as a store of wealth or however you choose to see it. And so I guess I don't like relying on that idea, the idea that it's a popularity-driven outcome.
I get reminded of, it's funny, you remind me of They asked Warren Buffett, you know, I think it was like, were you investing in the stock market during World War II or something? Bloody old guy, isn't he? And I think he said yes. And they were like, were you worried about it? You know, the volatility. And he just said something like, all I needed to believe was that America would win the war, was what he said, I think.
Okay.
And I think that always like struck with me because that's like the thing is like when you buy indexes as opposed to something like crypto or whatever and housing too. Often you're just banking on the fact that you think Australia, in our case, and the world, if you're investing globally, will be a better place in 2040 than in 2030 and a better place better place in 2040 than 2020. And that's the fundamental question, right? And if you answer the question, I think the world is going to be in absolute shambles and disaster. That's probably the only reason I could imagine from a philosophical standpoint that it's just like, maybe you shouldn't invest in the stock market or indexes then, because that is the one way the house crumbles with, to your point, bricks and businesses. So, you know, it's interesting how that kind of thinking has informed, you know, you steering clear of crypto and stuff as well. And did you have much money in cash?
No, like what, 1%?
1%.
1% of my wealth, yeah. So, nah, not really. That's pretty low.
Do you even bother with like a high interest saver or term deposit or something, or like you have such a small amount of wealth that you mostly just keep it in a transaction account, a small amount of cash wealth that just stays in a transaction account?
Yeah, so I would, but because we have mortgage debt, I just keep any cash we have in an offset account, which helps save interest on the loan. But yeah,
I'm still speaking like someone who's never owned a home, Dave.
That's all right. But yeah, if we didn't have any sort of housing debt or any mortgages, then yeah, I would just put that small amount into a high interest savings account and then keep as little as possible, very, very, very little in a transaction account, just enough to until like the next little blob of money was going to hit the bank account.
So I never considered that because you've owned houses for a long time. So you just probably haven't had a savings account for like forever because you just have it all in offset, right?
Yeah, I haven't had a savings account since I was maybe like 21 or something like that.
That's fascinating. Savings accounts are like the spiritual center of my life, getting that monthly interest payment from the bank.
Oh, man, how good is it? I was so addicted to getting that monthly interest payment. I got hooked on that straight away. And because back when I started saving, I suppose, I was putting any surplus cash I had in this high interest savings account. And it was paying decent amounts back then. I think it was like 5.5 or 5.7. This is probably like, oh man, when would it have been? 2009, 2008. It was after the GFC, rates dropped, but then rates went back up.
Right, yep.
And so I think I was getting 5 point something on my savings account. And I was, you know, just because every time you see your interest come in, it would be higher than the previous month because you've saved money and you've reinvested the interest.
Yeah.
And so the payment goes up and I was just like, wow, this is awesome. And it's like $70, $80, $130. And I got it up to 200 and something a month. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. but then eventually I bought a property. So that kind of ended. But I found that to be super enjoyable.
I love that. And I can relate because, like, I mean, I take it seriously when it comes to my wealth because I guess there's a lot of money. Like, I'm one of those people that if there's a bank with a better interest rate that looks like it's going to stick and a solid introductory offer, I'll usually just jump ship. I'm not that sticky with banks.
I've got a question on that. I don't look at savings accounts really at all, but I'm aware that most of them do this introductory offer to try and get you in and then they'll lower the rate after 3 months or something like that. Is there much of a difference between the high interest savers with the very juicy introductory rate and then the high interest savings accounts that are just like a pretty good rate all the time as opposed to trying to lure you in? Is there much of a difference between those two? Like, are you better off bank hopping? I suppose it depends on the amount of money, but is there much of a difference between the steadily good rate versus the juicy trying to get you in rate?
That's a great question. I think the last 5 years, the answer is no, there's not much of a difference. Like, I'm with Eubank and I've been with them for a long time and they have, I don't know what it is now, I'm just going to Google it. Right now, their savings rate looks like it's 5.1%.
Live research for the podcast. This is great, mate.
All you have to do with Eubank to get 5.1%, this is not an ad, is like you just have to deposit like go read the website. I think you only have to deposit $100 a month into the account. It doesn't even have to keep going up. It's a very, very low barrier to entry savings rate, right? And I think
that's pretty good.
It's very nice. I've been with them for like years now, but the ones I see that are better than it are maybe like the 5.3s or something. And a lot of the times, usually...
Oh, that's not much.
No, it's not. The conditions around it will be like it's either an introductory rate. Honestly, you mostly only see that from the big banks, like the big four, or they're the ones who like give you crap, well, relatively speaking, but they give you great stuff at the start. But the biggest ones are like how much money you have to put in a month, whether the balance has to keep going up, and then how many card transactions that you make on the account too. And I usually steer clear of like the card transactions one because I mostly make, like I get my transactions done through a big four bank because it's just easier. And then I keep my savings with Eubank and like, I don't want to have two bloody cards that I have to use a month and figure this kind of thing out. It's too complicated, but it's crazy, man. Like young people figure this stuff out, making myself sound old, I guess. But because I said this to a friend, I was like, oh, you know, like I don't, they said, oh, Bank of Queensland's higher. It's got a higher rate. And I was like, yeah, but you got to do 5 card transactions. And that's like 5 things to remember a month. And he's like, no. If you just download the Beemit app and you just beam yourself $1 5 times from Bank of Queensland back to CommBank, it counts as 5 transactions. You just do it. He's like, it takes you like 60 seconds a month and you tick that criteria. And I was like, oh my God. You know, so there's all this kind of complexity to it. But I think like, yeah, to your question. There's always a workaround. I think the neobanks have done a pretty good job, like that kind of 86-400, Eubank, UpBank, the Bank of Queensland. They've done a good job at making this a lot more accessible. So I think bank hopping, I see it done a lot less these days. But yeah, the gap isn't that big for all those, the extra couple of percent and all the effort you have to do.
Yeah, okay. No, that's good to know. Thanks for clearing that up. I definitely wouldn't. No, man. I wouldn't jump through any hoops to get an extra point, whatever. I hate hoop jumping exercises. I would almost avoid that just on principle.
The other thing to quickly mention is that it's honestly really scary too, because like, I don't remember which bank, but there was one bank where it was like, you only get, I think maybe it's like Bank of Queensland or something. Doesn't matter. You only get the interest. So like, to get the interest for the money you have in February, you have to have completed the criteria in January. So like in January, you have to put in the whatever dollars and do the card transactions, and that unlocks the interest in February. And that's really scary, not scary. That's, you have to be careful, because if you're a consumer who doesn't know a lot about this, and then you're with like a Combank or something, you move your money across to BOQ thinking you're going to go from 5% to 5.3. You suddenly miss that month of January. Or like, you have to be more thoughtful about it and be like, I'll just put in $100 in January into this new bank account. Keep all my, like, it gets so complicated. And like, I really wouldn't recommend it to people unless you are really chasing the dollars. Like, if you're at that point in your life financially where you're chasing the dollars, it's a great way to benefit, because it's just, you know, reading details. I do also just want to preface again, please don't listen to me on specific offers with specific banks, because it changes all the time and I might have gotten a bank wrong. So go read the websites if you are curious about a particular bank account.
Good suggestion. All right, just before we wrap up, mate, do you want to share, like, there's one other question that people might have as they're listening to this. We've shared a bit about how our portfolios or how our wealth is sort of broken down at the moment, but like you sort of mentioned that you quite likely buying an apartment soon. So how will our wealth or how will our investment sort of breakdown change over the next few years? Is there any plans? Is there any sort of things that you can see happening on the horizon? What's the situation going forward?
Yeah, I can answer that first for you, Dave. I think I'll give you the quick hits of things. One of them is I want to simplify my portfolio down. I think I still have too many things. I think I have like 5 ETFs. That's one of them. The second one is probably like, now that I, or not now, but like if I own an apartment, that's quite a heavy exposure to Australia now too. So I might want to kind of think about if I weight my kind of ETFs a little further away from Australia. And I think the third thing for me is reflecting on income more. You know, Perla pays, like, let's just look at, say, Perla, right? Like, my income for Perla is around the 100K mark, right? And that's in that, like, call it like 37 tax bracket. So just for simplification, you know, theory, it's like, sure, I can go get all these dividends from VAS, all these dividends from cash interest, but I'm still losing money because I'm earning it. And we talked about this before. So really reassessing, like, what's my plan with income in the next years? And should I use that to maybe drift more towards the, you know, high growth, low dividend thing? So, but that's only something I've been thinking on a week, but it's something I'm trying to consider quite a bit, as like maybe moving away from dividends. But we'll see what happens. They're probably the main ones on my mind right now. What about you?
Yeah, so I'd say that, like I mentioned a bit earlier, I'll probably still continue, well, not probably, I definitely will continue transitioning away from property and towards shares. So that was the plan ever since, even before I left work, that was the plan that I was going to follow for the following 10 years or so. And so it's been about 7 years now, and there's still a couple of properties in the portfolio. So they're in Perth too, by the way, which is, Perth is doing quite well at the moment in terms of the property market. So
you guys weren't for a while, were you?
No. Perth's been like the joke of the country for like the last 10 years, man, or maybe even longer, actually.
I'm happy for you all over there. Bit of a change, I guess.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a long time between drinks, mate. But yeah, so I'll probably continue doing that and sell a property possibly next year, and then maybe sell another one a year after that or something, depending on what's sort of happening in the market. I'll try and do it at a time when it is a good time to sell. And I know it's a good time to sell now, but I don't expect that to change anytime soon based on the way the market is. So it's only really started growing in the last couple of years. So I would expect that to continue just based on a few fundamental things in the market, and the fact that it had more or less a 10-year dead period. So I'll do that, keep building the share portfolio, maybe even simplify it further, like I hinted at earlier.
The real estate trust, is that what you kind of look at first? Or
Yeah. Definitely. I'll definitely look at that first. So if they do really well, maybe over the next few years, I might offload those, and then just I'll use that money to top up my VAS and VGS, and that'll pretty much be it. I don't think I'll do anything else other than that. I don't think I'll sell those and go to one holding. I like having two. At least it gives me something to do. I top up the one that's sort of underperformed or lagging a bit. So, yeah, it gives me some sort of control and that. So, yeah, that's the plan.
My last question for you today, Dave, as we wrap up is, I talked about how I'm kind of considering, you know, if dividends are a bad thing for me right now, given that I have a lot of years of working ahead of me. As a fired, relaxed, at-home Perth person, do you ever consider things the other way? Like when you think about selling down your investment properties, which, you know, might be income earning, do you think I'll probably actually disproportionately be buying VAS, a dividend earning ETF, as opposed to a growth ETF?
You know, I can tell you don't invest in property because you just referred to it as income earning.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hopeful for you, you know.
You're forgetting the expenses and the mortgages, mate. So, but yeah, if they weren't there, yeah, it'd be great. So, no, the answer to that is mixed. So, essentially, the properties that we have now provide, we're still having to put money in our pocket, essentially, to cover the costs of the properties because of mortgages and costs, even though the rent's gone up over time and even though the debt has come down over time. So, by just adding simply to our two index funds, even if we do that equally, so not really favoring one, not really favoring VAS over VGS, then that will still provide us a pretty decent income stream, somewhere in the region of like 4% for both of those. Is kind of like a blended yield that would give us. But in terms of income, that was the main reason why I moved to shares in the first place, which you might remember. And in the beginning, I was very income focused because I needed the money. I needed the income essentially to live on, right? So if I can get a nice juicy income stream, then I want that. As long as the asset value or whatever would stay roughly intact over time, then I'm happy with that. So that was the idea of moving towards dividend focused portfolio, which I had in the first several years of retirement. Even now I have a relatively, you could say it's a relatively uneven portfolio that it does lean more towards income and yield. So I have only maybe 30% or maybe a little bit more right now of my share portfolio in VGS. So that's a relatively Aussie heavy portfolio. So it does spit out a nice income, which is quite enjoyable in retirement, as you might imagine. But yeah, building up the VGS over time. And it also helps that we've continued earning income after retirement, which I didn't plan on. And so that doesn't seem to be going away. So the idea that I would lean towards income now makes a lot less sense. So I'll keep kind of balancing the portfolio out further and make it a bit more of a nice even mix.
Sure, because there's obviously a benefit to having a nice globally balanced portfolio in terms of risk. And if you don't desperately need those dividends right now, then keep it balanced.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the plan. And like you said, I could actually sell some global shares for income if I needed to anyway. That's probably a conversation that we could have another day too.
Yeah.
How to live off a portfolio and things like that, different ways.
Yeah. Sounds good. That makes sense. I think it's been good to talk about the cash elements, the crypto elements, the investing elements, the property elements. It's very evident, you know, we both have different situations, which has kind of made it pretty fun to kind of see how much they vary. I don't think there's been a whole lot of similarities between you and I on the journey, except that we ended up kind of liking similar indexes and approaching that the same way. But I like that we seem to be thinking long term with all of this stuff and always trying to actually build it out towards the long term and not make quick wins. I know my crypto days sound like I was trying to, but honestly, I was just freaking out and scared half the time.
What you should have done was max out a credit card and then put that.
Dave, I had friends that turned $40,000 of cash into $1 million of crypto, and then it went back down to 100K before they decided to sell out. It was a absolute dark. It was a dark time.
A lot of
time
behavioral traps.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Sorry, last thing. That's why I kind of stopped too. It was just horrifying to be around, like that association. When I said like I got cynical about it, it was like seeing, you would see things on like Reddit of people bad mental health situations because of Bitcoin and stuff. And I was like, it's like snake oil to me now. Anyway, let's move on. So, you know, I think let's do another one of these podcasts sometime in the future, because obviously like what's going to happen between now and a couple of years from now, I'm probably going to have more property and you're probably going to have less, and we'll probably have changed our share portfolio, or I shouldn't lump you into that. I'll probably change mine. You seem like you figured out a lot. And I'm glad that we both, you know, intend to keep investing in what way we can.
I'm sure things will change over time because it tends to for everyone, regardless of whether they've been investing for quite a while or they've just started. And I think that's one thing that beginners need to take note of. Sometimes they can pressure themselves into thinking that they need to come up with like the perfect portfolio or the right thing that they're going to set and forget forever. But that rarely tends to happen. A lot of times we do tend to tweak things and change things and adjust our holdings over time as we learn more and we gain more familiarity with how we want to invest personally and then how we interact with those investments themselves and when they go up and down and how our behavior kind of stays under control or not in those particular situations like you mentioned, mate. But yeah, well, we can do a follow-up of this in a couple of years' time. That might be good. But it's fairly clear that we're both relatively boring, I would say, in our approaches. But I don't think there's anything really wrong with that. And yeah, let's hopefully we can keep building our wealth over time, mate, and hopefully our listeners can too.
Yeah.
So we hope you enjoyed this peek behind the scenes into how we invest today. If you have any questions that you want us to answer on the show, you can send them to us at hello@aussiefirepod.com. Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you in the next episode.
See ya. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Aussie Fire. For more FI inspiration, head to Perla.com to browse our resources, calculators, and community insights. Perla is an authorized representative, number 128-1540 of Sandland Private Wealth, Pty Ltd, with AFSL number 337927. Knowledge is power, especially when investing. So always seek advice and or check out the relevant disclosure document for any financial product, including the PDS and TMD before deciding. These are available from the product issuer's website. When you invest, your capital is at risk, and past performance is not a reliable indicator of future investment returns.